Although I don't have any members. What happened? He just like walked out?
Shelley, I think we're going to go off mics.
Hey, good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. I was like, I did have one member. It is Wednesday, May 15th, and I just want to provide an update on the agenda so everybody knows what's happening today and what isn't. We are going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2025A, because we're working on an amendment for that, and we're going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2801A. So just want to reiterate, if anybody's here for that, you are welcome to go or stay. So no bison today. We'll carry over the bison. Okay, with that, and we will do the work sessions at the end, because we have a lot of folks here today for public hearings. So with that, we will go ahead and open up a public hearing on, we will start with House Bill 3441A, because we have a number of representatives, senators like to testify on that, and that way they can go back to their business, and we can, we'll do the other bills in the order that's listed after that. So Beth, can you provide us with an overview on House Bill 3441A?
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3441A has a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the bill. The measure establishes the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Board and specifies membership and duties. It stipulates the board consists of 13 members. It names the Hatchery Research Center located on Fall Creek near Alsea as the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, and it declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, we have a legislative panel that we'll start off with. And did you say there was another legislator that wanted to?
We'll say this.
What happened to Representative Witt? He was right behind us.
I'll give him a call.
I thought. Well, he was with us a minute ago. Yeah. He must have gotten absconded by a lobbyist. All right. Welcome, Representative. Would you like to start?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would. Thank you, Chair Ding, fellow committee members. For the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1, which is the South Coast. During the early part of 2001 legislative session, Representative Morgan, Senator Meserle, and then Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Lindsey Ball, met in my office. Mr. Ball presented his vision of a new salmon research center to be located on the Alsea River. We discussed the need for research, the benefits of having science to guide policy and hatchery management practices. Specific and the major focal point was the question, is there a difference between wild and hatchery fish? If so, what hatchery management practices caused or contributed to the difference, and how do we change the practices to lessen the negative effects on hatchery and wild fish? And that is key. That was the reason. That was the main question. That was the thing we've been waiting for. The cost of the facility was $6.5 million, plus we have spent another $10 million plus operating the facility. All of those operating dollars and stuff come from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, not from Oregon State University. What we know today, specific to the reason the hatchery was built, can be printed on a postage stamp using large print. We have both an agricultural research center and a forest research center at Oregon State University. As legislators, we have heard many times the need for these centers and the hundreds of millions of dollars of value that Oregon has received from them. The need to have science drive fisheries management is crucial and is supported by nearly all of the Department of Fish and Wildlife constituent base. The bill changes the makeup of the research board, provides oversight to the research center's projects and their status. Oregon ORS 496-275 gives direction to the Oregon Department to review and revise existing statute administrative rules so that the different forms of hatchery production are recognized as necessary and critical element in the state's salmon production system in order to provide harvest opportunities for Oregon citizens. Identify needed monitoring and evaluation activities to ensure protection of natural spawning fish populations. And I think that is really important. The whole thing is to find out how we can not have negative input on the wild fish population and to assess contribution of such cooperative projects to Pacific fisheries. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife cannot comply with ORS 496-275 without a research center. I handed out a paper just a minute ago to you and I wanted to read the list for, so it's in the public record. The groups that endorsed 3441, Associated Northwest Steelheads, Oregon Salmon Commission, Salmon for All, Mackenzie River Guides, Oregon Chapter Trout Unlimited, Native Fish Society, Coastal Conservation Association, Oregon Concrete Producers, Special Districts and Ports, and that is because our ports are so dependent on having mortgages and salmon opportunity and launching. Oregon's for Food and Shelter, Oregon Small Woodlands Association, LC Sportsman, Oregon Farm Bureau, and Carpenters Union. House Bill 3441 helped guide research and give OSU and Oregon Department of Fish a direction on research projects. We all need to have open minds and embrace new science to guide fish management. I met just last week with Brett Brownscombe from the governor's office and also Richard Whitman. I expressed that I had would like to explore the need to expanded funding for research projects. Oregon, I feel, needs to commit the resources, and I believe the constituent base of the department will, in fact, support that when they know those monies are put into meaningful resources. There are some amendments, Madam Chair, that were brought forward. I have a copy of them. We discussed them recently, and I wanted to read a few things out of that, and I'll finish then. Look at the recommendation 3. Board of layperson will not only not have the expertise to produce research, a lay board that approves research projects result in a loss of credibility for the Oregon Hatch Research Center. Without scientists on the board, the typical layperson will not have the background and capability to propose research. A layperson board without scientists that approve science proposals will not have credibility in the science community, and therefore the center will lose credibility. The 50 co-sponsors are laypersons. The 14 constituents groups with tens of thousands of members are laypersons. The unanimous vote on the House floor were those foolish legislative laypersons. According to the components, the proponents of the amendments, we don't have expertise, we will cause loss of credibility, we don't have proper backgrounds and capabilities, we laypersons are not going to bring credibility to the science community, and I felt that that entire proposal is extremely arrogant. In fact, it's about as arrogant as anything I've seen in the 13 years I've been here in the building. They worry about how their science will appear. They worry about their credibility. They worry about the name being published on a scientific paper, and they're getting credit for it. Those unqualified, ignorant board members, those unqualified, ignorant 50 co-sponsors, those unqualified, ignorant legislators have a different concern and vision. We want sound research to guide fish management. We want to do what's in the best interest of the fish. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Arnie Roblin. I am senator from Senate District 5, which goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and from the Bay into the Valley, actually, as far as Sheridan. I'm here in support of this bill for a number of reasons, and I have had the opportunity to talk with a lot of people, including your chair, about why, to me, this is an important bill. And you've heard the history from Representative Krieger. We've been on this process now for 8 or 9 years, actually a little longer, almost a decade. And since the hatchery has been built, almost 7 years. And I know that research takes a long time, but the issue is we have not, as a state, invested in the research that I think we need to do. The research that's been done at the hatchery, for the most part, has been done by grant money that has come from graduate students and the university, Oregon State University people going out and getting grants and then coming in and studying the things that they felt is really important. A number of graduate students, including doctoral students, have used that facility. I think that's an outstanding use of the facility. But we built it with Oregon money, and we staff it with Oregon staff people to find out answers that help us. And as you know, I've worked really hard this session on trying to get some research money developed for research on the Oregon coast. We've got new reserves that we believe need to have research done, and we need to find the resources to do that. Well, this is a program that I believe strongly we need to invest research money in. And we have to have the oversight that money will be spent to answer some really important questions. And for me, it's exactly the questions that were had when we first started this. What's the interaction between wild fish and hatchery fish? How can we make sure that that interaction does not hurt the wild fish and at the same time produces fish that will be there for sport and commercial fishing for the future? If you look at our hatchery system, and I want to give kudos to our hatchery system, we do as good a job as any hatchery system in the world in producing high-quality fish that go out and come back and get caught. And in my bay in particular, our fall fishery is amazing to watch what's happening, and a lot of step and other kind of stuff. And so our hatcheries are improving over what they used to do. But the vision of this hatchery was to make sure that we kept ahead of the curve, that we invested in research that let us know what's the best way to do the best we can with hatcheries. And our goal with this bill is to get the lay people back engaged in understanding research and working with scientists and seeing the kinds of things that are done, and then taking that back to their constituents to continue to say, we need to fund our natural resource agencies, including Fish and Wildlife, so that they can do the research. We haven't actually proposed a research proposal from Fish and Wildlife because we haven't been giving them the funding to do that. And we've got to find ways in which we can find the funding. I have told Senator Dingfelder that I think that 5% of the general fund should be going to natural resource agencies so that we can actually start doing the things that we think are important, and that's across the board. Right now it's less than 1%. And this fish, once you get a lay board really engaged in making decisions and understanding and working with scientists, what I find is that those same people become the advocates to come here and start looking at each of us in the face saying, we need to do this research. We need to find out how to not have impacts. We need to do the things that will make, in the long run, a better fisheries for all of us. And that's the goal of the hatchery. It's, I think, the goal of the people who put over $6 million into it when we built it, and it's what we need to be able to be saying, we're going to do some ongoing, consistent funding, and when you get a good, active board working hard to make sure those things happen, you have a much better chance of that happening. And I encourage you to look at this bill, and I would hope that as we get moving forward, we make sure that we use the ALSI hatchery in the way it was originally designed to get answers to questions, or at least begin to answer questions that help inform us as legislators as we move forward in this amazing endeavor of trying to make sure that high-quality protein is out there, both that doesn't affect the wild populations, actually encourages the wild populations to grow, and then makes a commercial and sports fishery for all of us. So, thank you, and we'd ask any questions that people have. I'd be glad to answer.
Representative, do you want to add something?
Just a couple of questions, Madam Chair. There has been, to my knowledge, no pop in their budget since the hatchery was completed for a research project. We invest now, according to Jim Meyer, and I had him, he looked it up for me, $57 million a biennium between federal and state money for our hatchery system, $2 million a month, $500,000 a week, and we need to make sure that that investment is putting out the type of fish that do not interfere with wild fish and is the very best that we can. We can find the money. We need to do it.
Thank you. Let's see if there's any questions. Senator Hansel.
Yes. Representative Krieger, in the packet that you handed out, there were you have a page of suggested changes that I'm sure were brought to the I had another copy of them, too. I don't remember where I got it. But were any of these discussed as it worked its way through the House legislation? I mean, where did these come from, and why are they coming now?
Well, one of the things was we had the department and Mr. Elliker, several others, made, I believe there were 6 or 7 changes that they wanted. We accommodate 3 or 4 of those. There were 3 that I specifically felt it would gut the bill and not hold any accountability, so I did not want them in the bill. They testified that they were not going to oppose the bill, or told me they weren't going to oppose the bill. They did immediately run to Senator Roblin. Ed Bull specifically said he was going to try to kill the bill. That type of conduct of shopping committees, not being truthful with legislators who have worked with them and supported them, I don't think is very admirable type conduct. We again worked 4 years ago extremely hard to get their fee increase for them because we knew it was needed. And then they'd around slither behind our back doing these type of things. I don't much appreciate the department anymore.
Okay, any other questions?
Yes,
Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. I've read the bill thoroughly and studied it. I can understand where the scientists would have
questions as to laypeople being on there. But on the other side of the coin, the laypeople are the ones that do this daily. They fish daily. They interact with the communities, and they understand. Do you find that it would be, or would you think that we could have a better mix if we put more scientists, maybe three or four instead of 11 laypeople?
Chair Dingfelder and Senators, the original board had, I believe, two or three scientists on it. In 7 years, what did they produce?
Zero.
It also, excuse me, just a minute. Yeah. The bill allows the director to appoint three, one from Oregon State University, one from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and one from a federal agency. All of those can be scientists. Also, the people who are specific in the bill to be appointed could have a scientific background. I know I've had conversations with Jim Myron about their possibly having a person available to fill one of those wild advocacy slots with a person who has a science background in fisheries. There will be enough people there. Their approval of those scientific projects is what is going to be the job now of the Oregon State University and Department of Fish and Wildlife to propose projects or receive proposals and then explain to the board the validity of that project and its value.
And, you know, I'm probably, if there was a couple scientists on there, it probably isn't going to be a big issue for me. I will tell you this, that I believe that lay people who come with interest in those kinds of things and have the proposals explained to them become much better informed and then can take that out and explain to other local people all around. And we build a constituency of people who are looking for that science to be the informer. And to this point, the issue has been that most of the science that's been done and the projects that have been approved have been about graduate student work, where they've gone out and got the grants. And I think that's going to continue the same. What we're asking for is to make sure that we invest some and ask some of our own questions and have those questions answered over time. And there's nobody that I think doesn't want the science to be the one that drives that. You get the question, but then to build the experiment, to do the deal, and to plan that needs to be done by really great scientists. And we have those in the state. Oregon State has some exceptional scientists that would do and drive the whole experience. It's just asking to have another group that's looking at those things and saying, yes, is this the good use of this hatchery in this time to do these kinds of things? And I think that they can do a good job with that. But I think that as they have the explanations of what they're asking for, what the questions are, I think all of us will become better informed people because of that interaction.
I know we've discussed hatcheries many times in this committee for the 3 years I've been on it now, and one of the things that I always ask the question on, can you tell the difference between native fish and hatchery fish? And it's interesting that we've had a facility open for this long, and we still can't answer that question. So, and the other reason I'm smirking is poor Senator Bates is trying to get his mouse to work, and I pulled his thing out.
Oh, jeez.
There's shortage
this is
of
a
panics
nice committee,
over in
yeah.
the Senate.
Control.
We have a good committee.
At least it's the vice chair.
I'm a doctor, and I know where to put this now.
Oops.
Uh-oh. Wow. Yeah. This is getting more interesting down at this end of the dais.
Next one down. You stated that you didn't know who could tell the difference between wild fish and hatchery fish. Well, according to some proponents, the hatchery fish swim upside down and backwards and don't know what they're doing or where they're going.
Well, I will say this, Representative Krieger, when you mentioned that the carpenters were on your list of supporters, I can understand why, because I've been a proponent of jobs forever, and these guys are out of work, so they got a lot of time to fish.
I will tell you that that from my observations at the mouth of many of these rivers for the last 15 or 20 years where I've actually taken time to look, the cormorants don't seem to have an understanding about one or the other. They eat them both,
right.
And they eat a lot of them.
And
so whether they're hatchery-produced or others, in fact, I often contend that the wild fish make it because they've got all these other hatchery fish swimming out there in front of them so they can get eaten first.
Well,
because
Senator, I've heard the other side of that argument. They say that the wild fish are being predated upon because there's more hatchery fish there, and they wouldn't eat the wild fish if the hatchery fish weren't around. So
oh, there you go.
You've got all these arguments. So.
But I just
any other questions for
yeah.
the gentleman? Because we have a bunch of fishermen in this
true.
Room, and if we let them talk fish stories all day long,
that's
we
true.
Will never be able to get everybody up here to testify.
I'm going
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm trying to keep a straight face, but I'm just going nuts.
We'll have to remember that trick for the future. I actually am going to call the department up next, Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have Kurt Melcher and Bruce McIntosh, and then we have some other people who'd like to testify on this bill.
Remember 2 weeks ago, I stole your mouse.
Yeah, I know. But
good thing my scooter's gone, because
if you want to move to the other end, where it's safe.
Okay, welcome, gentlemen. Whoever, Kurt, you going to go first?
Thank you, Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, and I'm handing out written testimony, or written version of my testimony as well. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about House Bill 3441. And I did want to mention that we did testify on this bill on the House side. We did offer comments and amendments, not in a formal structure, but to many of the bill's proponents. And we expected to continue to work on this bill as it arrived over here on the Senate side. So I'll just give you a little, and you've heard much of this already, so I'll try and be very brief and then be happy to answer any questions you might have. But the legislature created the Oregon Hatchery Research Center in 2003. The facility began operations in 2005, so about 8 years ago, barely two generations, or a little less than two generations in terms of the life cycle of Chinook salmon. The facility is owned by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and it's run and managed by us in conjunction with Oregon State University. The head scientist there is a faculty member at Oregon State. His salary is paid equally, half by the department as well as half by Oregon State University. Early on in the process, we worked with the independent multidisciplinary science team and others to form a research plan for the facility, actually before the facility was even open, and also formed an ad hoc, if you will, advisory committee, which, as it's currently populated, includes 15 members that represent four representing science, one representing sport fishing, one commercial fishing, one conservation, one watershed councils, one local government, one resource producers, that could be agriculture or timber, and one education, representing K-12 education, one representing the tribes, one federal government, and two representing the public at large, so a 15-member advisory committee. That advisory committee has been meeting quarterly. I think there's several members here today that will share perspectives as well on their experience with the committee. The Hatchery Research Center research plan, as I mentioned, that was developed in conjunction with the independent multidisciplinary science team includes two tiers of research. One tier is focused on advanced scientific research or basic research to understand underlying differences that may exist between hatchery and wild fish. And the tier two of the research plan then is operation and applied research that would develop improved fish culture and propagation practices in light of the differences between hatchery and wild fish. As mentioned, House Bill 3441A would establish a new 13-member board that provides oversight for the research center. The board includes 10 voting members. And we are one of several entities that have been advocating and will continue to advocate for at least some scientific representation on the board. While it's true there are three agency seats named in the bill, one representing the state, one representing Oregon State University, and one representing the federal government, those are all non-voting members of the committee. And we think it's important to have some science representation on the board as it relates to credibility, and we certainly don't belittle the participation of laypersons. In fact, the vast majority of our agency are non-scientists, so that's certainly not our view. So we do recommend that the board include some scientific representation. With regard to the relationship between ODFW and OSU, it's a very important relationship. Of course, as I mentioned, we share the salary of the senior scientist there, as well as we do operate the facility with our funds. And 3441A, as currently written, has the ODFW director hiring the research center director. And the research center director is a professor at OSU, a member of the OSU faculty. We really believe that it ought to be the OSU hiring their faculty member, with certainly with consultation from us, which is the case right now. And with that, I do have Dr. Bruce McIntosh here as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. There has been research going on at the facility. We do have some information that we can provide to you after the hearing if you'd like.
Thank you. So, Bruce, did you want to add anything now, or are you just here?
Here to answer questions.
Okay. He brought his lifeline with him, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. I actually have some questions that I wanted to just ask, and then we'll open it up to the rest of the committee. But when we met yesterday, and I had asked you to, I recall, because I was here when this was created, $6.5 million created the Hatchery Research Center. That was, if I recall right, that was not with general funds, that was with license fees, or what was the source of funding for that, if you can remind me? It's been about over 10 years.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, I honestly do not recollect what that initial seed money was that paid for the construction. Certainly we could dig that up, but unless Bruce knows off the top of his head.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce McIntosh, Acting Fish Division Administrator of the Department. I don't have the exact figures either, but a large chunk of it came from lottery dollars.
Oh. My trusty staff just pulled it up. $1.125 million from the Restoration Protection Research Fund, and oh yes, that's right. $4 million was from Measure 66, so lottery funds for capital construction. From the capital construction, I think that might have been why I voted no on the bill originally, actually. So and we'll send this around to the committee members, because I just want to read this for the record, because I could not recall, but the three primary goals for operation in the Hatchery Research Facility, and this is what passed 10 years ago, was first, research at this facility will seek to better understand the mechanisms that may create differences between hatchery and wild salmon and steelhead. Second, research will develop approaches to manage those differences to meet fishery and conservation objectives. And third, the research facility will help Oregonians to better understand the role and performance of production hatcheries in supporting and protecting Oregon's native fish. The facility be operated as a research facility and not as a production hatchery. Okay, so we'll send that around to the committee, because I think it's important that they see that original language. The question I had is, and then there was a workshop, and I have the notes of the workshop here to define what the principal research objectives were. Would you say, do you think the facility has met those objectives? And I can read them. I think you probably have a copy. Maybe you can walk the committee through, because I think it's important to have an understanding, since we put this into place, paid for, or allocated the funds 10 years ago. Here we are 10 years later. As you said, it's been operating now since 2006. Have we been able to answer some of the original research objectives that we proposed when we envisioned this research center?
Sure. I'll take a high-level stab at that, and then also ask Bruce to weigh in. But I think when we all look back, certainly the center has not achieved what many of us had expected. And we expected that there would be very aggressive grant seeking and outside money essentially coming into the facility to conduct a lot of this research. Some of that has occurred, but certainly not to the extent that we envisioned. And as the representative and senator mentioned earlier, the state funding that's going into the center right now is really to keep the doors open, the lights on, have staff there to run the facility for research that's conducted. And most of that, or much of that, has been by graduate students and others that bring their own grant money to do their own research, not that may or may not be entirely what, you know, the questions that we would have liked to have had answered. So, Bruce, I don't know if you want to touch on that a little bit.
Sure, I'd be glad to touch on that a little bit more. You know, the Hatchery Research Center is a marvelous research facility and a great place to do research, but more importantly, it's a place for scientists to collaborate. And I think that's something we have to remember when we're looking at this. Oregon's blessed with some of the best researchers in the world in terms of looking at hatchery and wild fish interactions at Oregon State. And they have worked collaboratively with Dr. Noakes and the staff to address some of these real fundamental issues. Some work that Dr. Bluen did at the Hood River really established that we do see significant differences when wild fish are brought into the hatchery, put out into the wild, performance differences between those hatchery and wild fish. And it happened really in one or two generations, 3 to 8 years' time, very quick. What we've been able to establish out of that research is that that's really not a genetic change. That's really about an environmental change. And through Dr. Bluen's research and now in collaboration with Dr. Noakes and at the Hatchery Research Center, they're actually looking at what are the actual mechanisms that drive that. And it's largely believed to be gene switching. So actually the things we do in the environment of the hatchery turn genes on and off and create survival disadvantages to hatchery fish in the wild. So they're actually conducting the research right now to figure out what exactly are the mechanisms, the things we're doing in the hatchery that would ultimately drive those differences. And just in recent conversations with them, we're probably close to understanding what that is and being able to figure out how we put that into practice in our facilities. In terms of looking at how do hatchery fish readapt to the natural environment, that's not an area that we have put a lot of focus in, but at the same time, we've implemented some research in Salmon River on the North Coast where we removed the hatchery program. It was a small program, wasn't very productive. Hatchery or wild coho were pretty much non-existent there. This was in 2007. If you look at the population of wild fish now, they have varied between 500 to 2,000 wild fish. Those are all progeny of those hatchery fish. And so the good news is these are not long-term genetic effects we're seeing. They are largely environmental effects, and when you take that pressure away, the fish have an opportunity to respond. In terms of the consequences of hatchery operations to native fish, some of the previous speakers touched on a number of those. We know that when we reduce, you know, hatchery fish, when they outmigrate as smolts, they go out volitionally. They go out with the flows. They go out with temperatures, different factors across the springtime. Hatchery fish, our tradition has been to open the door and let them out. And so you get a giant pulse of smolts down in the basin. We've learned in places that becomes it does become a real attractant for predators. So we have modified practices and evaluating practices that allow the releases of those fish to be more like wild fish. So there are a whole suite of components going on there to get at those fundamental questions. And the last question really is, what are the operations we can modify? Well, we've already talked about some of those, and we're right on the cusp now of understanding some of those basic mechanisms of what creates those differences and how we change our operations. So I see that forthcoming in the next, you know, 2 to 4 years.
So I have a question that's maybe more for Kurt than for you, Bruce, but I have a list of the advisory committee member list that you currently have. Can you explain for the committee how are those member selected, appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate? Is this something the director selects? How? And I notice, by the way, on the existing list that it's a mix of both scientists and lay people currently.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. So that our current Hatchery Research Center Advisory Committee is essentially ad hoc. It was created by the department. Its members are all appointed by the director, so there's no Senate or governor's office involvement there. And we did pick them to represent a large cross-section of folks who are interested in not just research, but also management and community activities and all the other things that are at play at this facility.
Yeah. I'll just pass it down so the committee can see. And so do you think that what's proposed in this bill will significantly alter the existing? I'm trying to just get a sense of what's being proposed and what we currently have and what the issues are that obviously some representatives and senators have brought this forward. So trying to figure out the difference between, you know, what's being proposed and what we currently have in place. I'm not seeing a huge differentiation in the actual positions. Although one of the things I noticed is we currently have watershed councils represented because of the linkage to the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds that wasn't proposed in the bill. But any other comments you have specifically? I'm not going to ask you to go down that list. But
just I'd say the primary difference between the two lists, if you will, is that the list in House Bill 3441A, as currently proposed, includes no specific scientific seats. Now, individual science folks are not precluded from appointment if they fit one of the other, one of the described roles or one of the described seats. But our current advisory committee has, I believe, it's four seats that are specifically for basically scientific representation.
And then two quick last questions. One is what I heard, I think you said, is that the research, it sounds to me like the research has been more opportunistic than directed by the agency. And I don't recall, I've been sitting on the Ways and Means Committee for 8 years, I don't ever recall a policy option package coming before our committee asking for funding for specifically for research, from the department. Is that correct?
Chair Dingfelder, that's correct. It has largely been opportunistic, and as I mentioned, I think everyone expected that there would be more outside money coming in to do look at some of these critical questions. That hasn't come to fruition as some expected, but no, we have not had a policy option package for additional state-funded resources.
And then my last question is in regards to, I know you have quarterly meetings, but have you done any type of conference or, it sounds to me, Bruce, what I'm hearing is from these questions that were originally identified as four principal research objectives, you've actually been able to provide information for that. But are there regular symposiums or forums or opportunities where that information gets out to the public besides this advisory committee?
Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, there haven't been symposiums per se, but there are annual newsletters put out with what the research is, ongoing research, proposed research, kind of key findings, those types of things. We've worked with our I&E department along with OSU's I&E folks to get that information out.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking, envisioning more like presentations where scientists get to come present their scientific information and peer-reviewed and that type of. So it's been more through, there hasn't been a formal process like we've been doing this research for X number of years, here's what we've found so far. What I think I'm hearing is that has not happened.
Chair Dingfelder, other than at the quarterly advisory committee meetings, certainly those folks have the researchers have made presentations at those committee meetings, but not to a broader audience.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I'll see if there's some other questions from any of my committee members. Senator Olson.
Yeah. Mr. Melcher, in looking at your testimony you have here, you had four representatives of the science industry. But these 15 members, these are all non-voting members, whereas in 3441, these new members will be voting members. Don't you think that would be more beneficial to have a voting member rather than a non-voting member?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, certainly we think that in House Bill 3441 that there should be, all the members should be voting members. There shouldn't be some agency folks who are, if they're named as a member, but they're non-voting members. We think they should all be voting members. But I think one of the important distinctions is the current advisory committee is there. They basically operate on consensus. They're advising the research scientist and at the research center. They don't have, I guess you would say, the same level of authority that's called out in House Bill 3441. They're simply an advisory board now, whereas in House Bill 3441, they're more than an advisory board. They're essentially a decision-making board that directs the work at the center. So, I mean, it's definitely stepped up.
Follow-up, please.
Yeah, follow-up.
And the reason I'm glad you asked that is when I look at the current board, we have four scientists, one sport fisher, one commercial fisher, and then we get into education, and the tribes would be appropriate, federal government, and a couple of public at large. Watershed councils, but when you look at 3441, it really seems to be made up of groups that would really be involved and be good stakeholders. We have the Oregon a member from the Oregon Salmon Commission, Columbia River Gillnet Salmon Fishery, fish advocacy groups, statewide sport angling organizations, agriculture because of the use of the water, coastal ports, which is important to the fisheries, forest products, definitely would be involved in that, would be appropriate, and the tribes, of course. To me, it seems like in 3441, it's a better makeup of people that would be have more interest in what's going on, and apparently from the brief introduction to this, it doesn't sound like the that what you were supposed to do has gotten done. So the question is, do we continue on a course that's not producing, or do we look at a course that perhaps could do better?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think Senator Dingfelder and Senator Olson, we're under House Bill 3441, we're certainly not advocating that any of those seats be removed. We're simply advocating that there should be some additional seats added.
Oh, so you just need a couple more scientists in there.
Right, we're not saying take some of these other people off and add. No, we're saying simply we don't take issue with any of those current, the language that's currently in there with regard to the current membership. We're just simply indicating that we think there should be some scientific representation added.
So let me, with one last follow-up question, and I'm going to put you on the spot now, Kurt. Do you think that the makeup of representatives on 3441 is a more or a better group to represent the necessities of this fishery, or do you think that what's currently in place is a better representation for the fishery?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Olson, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, certainly if you're looking at it from simply the lens of the fishing community and fish conservation community, I think 3441 is probably a better representation. I think our current advisory committee, since it is simply an advisory committee, that's not a board that's voting or has direct control of the research center. We tried to cover a great cross section of the communities without obviously having the committee so large that it was not functional.
Okay, we're going to take Senator Hansel's question. Before I do that, what I also hear, Senator, is a big difference is the role of these boards. Right now, the board, my understanding is, it serves. It's a primarily an advisory board.
That's right.
The way that I read the statute, it would have more than an advisory function. So I think that's what I'm hearing from the department.
And I agree with you, Chair, but also I, from testimony and from research, I find that this facility is lacking in its performance, and it perhaps we need to shake it up and make a change so that
that's
we get what we really want to get out of it.
I was going to say, my sense is that's why the proponents brought the bill forward. Senator?
Two quick questions. So Mr. Meltzer, follow up on what Senator Olson says. Does the department have any angst or problems with the members being voting members?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, I think, we were neutral on this bill. We were neutral on it on the House side. We didn't oppose it or support it. We offered constructive comments. I think we're comfortable with whatever direction you all collectively tell us to go. We do think that that having the board vote on individual research projects to approve or disapprove, we think, and OSU cannot be here today. They were booked, but we think that we do think that goes too far in terms of. Even though the words on paper are probably a lot scarier than the words in practice, nonetheless, perception is very important in the world of science, and we don't want to have a perception out there that the Research Center Board is somehow censoring work that may be going on at the facility.
And I will say, Senator, that I got an email today from one of the OSU scientists who cannot be here, and what I heard from him as major objection was about the issue that I just mentioned with Senator Olson. It's the advisory versus approval. And so I did receive some email. It's on OList, so everybody knows that, unfortunately, the OSU folks couldn't be here today.
My second question, mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I may. I think I heard you say that if we were to add a scientist to the board, or to whatever, increase the board number from 10 to 11 or 12. Currently it's at 15, right? So it would still be less than what we had before.
Right.
That would be acceptable to the department.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, absolutely we've been advocating for some addition of science members to the board. I think we did not have a fiscal on this bill because we have an existing advisory committee that meets quarterly that has 15 members. We're fully expecting that when this bill passes, our existing advisory committee will be dissolved, and those staff resources and fiscal resources that we're using to manage that committee will simply be moved over to this advisory board. So we have a zero or minimal fiscal on the bill for that reason. And so whether the board is 15 or 14 or 12 or 13, we don't have a strong feeling.
Okay, thank you. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. You're running short on time, so we've got some other people here that want to testify. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to call up Stan Steele, Jim Myron, and Doug Hunt. I'm just calling through the list here, and I'm going to ask folks, if you have written testimony, if you could please summarize it, because if you start reading it, I will probably cut you off. And we have two other bills to hear on this date, so we are running short on time. Brevity would be appreciated. All right. Jim, you want to get started since you're in the middle?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. I'm Jim Myron, representing the Native Fish Society, and you do have our written testimony, I believe. So let me just briefly summarize a few things. Native Fish Society supports the bill. We supported it in the House, and we support it still. And I just wanted to point out a few things. There is an excellent example in currently with the recovery of Oregon coastal coho. About 15 years ago, when ODFW realized that there was a real crisis with Oregon coastal coho, they made some serious decisions on how to go about recovering those fish, and they did it by closing the fishing season and eliminating the hatchery program on the Mid-Coast. Very serious decisions that needed to be made at that time. And as a result, the fish have responded by, they're certainly not recovered yet, but they're on the road to recovery. The fish populations of Oregon coastal coho are up in the hundreds of thousands when they were down into the tens of thousands 15 years ago. So, there's some example. That's a good example that we can use, I think, to help guide some of the things that need to be done with other fisheries, with other fish populations as well. So I just wanted to point that out. But for the Native Fish Society, the largest remaining barrier for the restoration of wild salmon and steelhead in Oregon are the hatchery program and the associated mixed stock fisheries that target the hatchery fish under those programs. And we need to do a much better job in both those areas, and hopefully the Hatchery Research Center can be utilized for the purpose of making some of those scientific findings that are necessary to guide those management decisions. But even if you can have the best science in the world, but if you don't put it into practice through your management policies, what good is the science? So there needs to be a follow-through by the agency of putting good science to use in the policy arena. So with that, I will be happy to answer any questions, but you can read the rest of my testimony.
Right. Stan, you want to go ahead? And I know you're not going to read your testimony.
No,
because it's four pages long. Right.
My name is Stan Steele. President of the Oregon Outdoor Council, and I want to thank you today for allowing us to come before you and speak about what we feel is an extremely important citizen science initiative. And in 2012, in Portland, Oregon, was a large symposium or conference that was held on this exact issue. And it, from that, you'll see there's four examples or several examples from that conference that I relate to in my information that I handed to you. But what it really is saying is this. Citizens and scientists, when they collaborate, when they work on issues, come up with some just astounding results, stuff that we can implement through whatever program we're looking at, whether it's atmosphere, whether it's habitat, or whether it's fish. So what we would say is that laymen are very, very capable, because the type of people that you're going to get involved in this process are going to be people that are very, very excited about the process. And Mr. Myron's absolutely correct that when we identify science and research projects, we have to make sure that we apply those findings. In my handout, you'll see four of the nine current projects that have been outlined by the department and the research center were actually ideas that came from anglers and other layman groups. Although others are taking credit in the science community, some of us know exactly how those original meetings went. And on the transfer and different release strategies, exactly one of those research projects that we're talking about. The Alcy Swartzman's Association had noticed a real problematic change in the harvest levels of winter steelhead from 120,000 release that had been historically there for years and years. But we went to a volitional release 100% at the hatchery instead of a scatter plant, which was moving those fish up and down the river and releasing at different points. What happened was an 8-year research project by Harry Wagner, former research director of ODFW, and Nancy McHugh in the early 80s had increased the production, angler harvest, to where we were getting approximately 13,000 fish a year being harvested by anglers out of a 120,000 release. Well, now we're around 1,200 with a 100% hatchery release. So ASA requested a specific research project checking on scatter planting and the impact that could have on harvest rates. And now we're finding that that's a science-based research project. In other words, it wasn't an idea coming from the layman. We want to work hand-in-hand on these issues, and the Hatcher Research Center is so perfectly positioned to do that. Citizen science is something that is the human dimension that we must really think about. And I think 3441 puts that human dimension back in play. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Doug?
Greeting, Honorable Chair, Senator Dingfelder, and other board members. My name is Doug Hahn. I'm a current member of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Advisory Board, representing public at large, and I'm on the Tualatin River Watershed Council as a fishery member. My background, I'm a retired environmental chemist, biology and chemistry degree, Portland State, and graduate work at University of Oregon Biochemistry. I'm a member of the Chemical Society in Portland. Oregon has made tremendous strides in their salmon recovery and present structure of research and education outreach at OHRC under direction of Dr. L.G. Noakes. Dr. Noakes has opened the meeting to local groups who have come and given their input of what they've wanted done with hatchery and native fish. And some of the recent publications show a ecological interaction of wild and hatchery salmonids through the North Pacific Ocean. There's also research projects on the Umpqua River Basin, effects of climate change in salmonids, geomagmatism, and also the olfactory imprinting related to homing and strain, the produced differences between hatchery and Chinook salmon and steelhead. I am in favor of keeping the current vision of the HB, so I'm in opposition to the House bill, but knowing that there is points on both sides.
All right, thank you, and thank you for your service. How long have you served on the current advisory committee?
5 years.
Thank you. We'll see if there's any questions for any of these gentlemen.
Just one, with tongue in cheek. Mr. Steele, there's 5 members on our board, not 4.
Excuse me, sir, what did I do?
You left me off.
Oh, no, I'm
no, that's
sorry.
Fine.
I
uh-oh.
Actually,
I hope you weren't...
Actually,
I was
off the website, so
yeah,
I,
no,
I,
which
I
is fine.
Very sorry, Senator.
So, Mr. Steele, you support the bill as it sits?
Well, yes, and, you know, what we have here is an opportunity to do what Oregon does best, and that's lead. And we have a facility that is operating at 20% capacity now. That's where it's been maxed out at. 20%, $1.4 million a year going into it from anglers. And what we really need to do is make sure that we maximize those, finding the research that can maximize how we can best diminish wild and hatchery-fish interactions that are negative, enhancing local communities through jobs that are provided, and we know provided very well by sport fisheries. So we have an opportunity here to change the game and to enhance the stakes that all of us are going to enjoy. I really think that to not do that and just lay the status quo sit there just means that we're going to try to do the same thing and expect a different result.
Mm-hmm. All right. Senator Hansel.
For Mr. Steele, would you have any problem if a scientist was added to the list of 10, make it 11 or something like that?
Absolutely would be a great addition, and that's where we can get this hand-in-hand working relationship. It's so important for us to really embrace. So often from the angling community, we look at things and say, we don't trust that science. Well, let's embrace it, and we embrace it by being a part of it. So, yes, I think that'd be great.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony today. And you're on my own watershed council, so thanks for coming here today. Okay, we have Dennis Ritchie, Bob Olson, and Tom Wolf. I know this trio will be brief.
Oh, he's got a stick. He's going to be whipping on us.
Yeah, but I'll make it short.
That's to keep Tom Wolf in line, actually.
She's heard of people.
All right, Bob, since you're on the far end there, why don't you go first?
Thank you, Senator Dinkfeld, our committee members, Bob Olson with Northwest Steelheaders. We are mainly here to note that this good bill before you would give the research board a more focused and meaningful role. The bill also addresses the need to statutorily give this program a clearer and more productive mission. It is important to reduce the current conflicts and risks that you've been hearing about between the different categories of fish, and this would move us in that direction. Accordingly, the increased stakeholder guidance coming from these changes will strengthen the research program that we have in this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mel. Mr. Ritchie?
My name is Dennis Ritchie, 2311 Jolly Point Road in West Lynn. Senator Dingfelder, Senators, I've been on the advisory board of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center since its inception. First year I was vice chair, the next 2 years I acted as chair. It's interesting that voting has been a bone of contention because we've been voting since I was on it. We have been voting on things right and left, and usually we don't have to have a major hand vote because of the good communications sent out by Dr. Noakes. We see all the information ahead of time. So by the time we go in, yeah, generally it's a consensus. But we have on at least 2 occasions voted to not allow some research at the facility because it did not meet our mission. There have been other split votes where we agreed to let the research go, and on 2 occasions we've told the young scientists to go back, rewrite it so it would more closely fit our mission. So the voting thing really isn't a big deal. We have a lot of scientists on there now, and it says at large, or most of them have science background. I went through the current member list, and there were only 3 guys that don't have any background in fishery science. The rest of us have probably more than we want.
And are you talking about the existing?
The existing group. Okay, so now, as it is, we have a lot of scientists, so adding scientists is no big
deal. Right,
but
the bill, it does, just so you're clear, the bill changes the makeup of the existing.
I know, but a lot of those people that will be applying for those positions used to work for NOAA, various things like that, and they have background. There would be more stakeholders on it. That's true. And I have no problem with adding a few scientists. But don't take the vote away, because then the board would be meaningless. It would be nothing. There would be no reason for it to be there. Several members have resigned from that committee because they had brought forth proposals for meaningful scientific research projects that were ignored. There is a science advisory committee that gives the yes or no to things before they ever come to this advisory board. That is why this bill came to be, was because there were many things that were nixed before we were allowed to see them. And it's not the staff there. Dr. Noakes is perhaps one of the best, well, I know he's one of the best in the world, and the top scientist as far as fisheries goes in the Pacific Northwest. We hired a winner. We want to keep him. And even if there were no other scientists on the board, with him there, it would not be a threat, believe me. And lastly, if the OHRC had met its goal, we wouldn't have this bill, and we also wouldn't have ODFW closing so many hatcheries and cutting them back to 20% of what they once put out. It's really affecting our economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom.
Chair Dingfelder's committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited supports HB 3441. We support the concept that Representative Krieger put forward. We think it's a good suggestion, and it's really interesting that a lot of groups that disagree on some subjects like hatchery management and the impact hatchery fish have on wild fish. You know, wild fish groups like Native Fish Society and Trout Unlimited are in support of, are working together on this bill with groups like Dennis's group, like Steelheaders. And we think that shows that a change needs to be made. I think that the concept of voting members that the bill has in it is a good one. And we don't oppose adding one to three more scientists to the voting thing. So, and just real briefly, as far as change goes, and I'll make this a very brief story. In 1999, my nephew played for Beaverton High School on the team, and they started off very well, but they ended up losing two games, and they changed their entire offense to meet the needs of the players they had, and they went on to win the state championship that year. And change needs to be made here in this current makeup of the board and how they're running the research center, because As everybody's alluded to, we haven't done as much as we could have, and we can make this better. So let's make a change. Let's go forward with the proponents of HB 341, and let's make the Hatchery Research Center the best facility it can possibly be. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this gentleman? Okay. Thank you very much. The last two up is Joe Rollator and Bruce Pulley. Do we have anyone else who would like to testify in this bill today? Okay, gentlemen, come on up. Again, I'm going to ask you to keep your remarks brief. We have two more hearings behind you. So, Joe, you want to get started?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, first of all, I'd like to apologize to all the people in this room that don't really care about fish, like the people that you heard before. We're really invested in this. It's really the thing that we do.
I'm the
guy who had to
Joe,
draft.
You need to put your name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got too excited.
I could tell.
My name is Joe Rollator. I'm here testifying today for myself. I live on the Alsea, 20 miles below the hatchery. I fish the Alsea a lot. I used to skip high school to come to the Alsea to chase steelhead. Because the hatchery is on my river, I've gone to a lot of these meetings, and I became somewhat concerned about the fact that I thought the hatchery had strayed from its original mission, and I wondered how, what the statutes were that developed this hatchery, what are they supposed to be doing? Well, it turns out there really are no ORSs that govern this hatchery. There's a budget note that says spend general fund and lottery money and some other money for this hatchery. And it's really interesting to me, and I'm sorry that I don't have more copies of this, but I have a copy on the web page. Is the Research Hatchery Center Advisory Committee mission, and it's marked draft version 3, 12-16-04. And you heard Representative Krieger say that the advisory board was appointed by the director, and you heard Kurt Melcher say that the advisory board was appointed by the director and the Fisher and Wildlife Department together. What it says here is appointments will be agreed upon by both ODFW Fish Division Administrator and OSU's Fisheries and Wildlife Department head. So that's why there's so much confusion. That's why I started drafting this thing. And I got a group of people together, and on the back of my testimony, Bruce, sure. Would you please help me here? Thank you.
What do you want to do with it?
Just give it to them.
Okay.
So on the back of my testimony, you'll see there are a whole bunch of people that participated in this, and they're all people that are invested in this. And one of the things I found out when I went to all these meetings was there were too many people. They never let the public talk. They didn't have an open discussion, and they just didn't have – it was too big. So I drafted this bill. It may not be right. We went through three different legislative drafts. We went through three different amendments in the House side. And again, I'm not saying that 3441A is going to solve the problems, but I think it's going to narrow the focus. And I'm really glad to hear that we're ready to start doing Tier 2 research. Thank you.
Thank you. Bruce.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pauley. I'm from Sherwood, Oregon. I'm a volunteer with the Coastal Conservation Association of Oregon. Our members believe strongly that hatchery fish are a vital part of what makes Oregon fisheries work. Approximately 80% of the salmonids that we catch in Oregon's fresh water are hatchery origin fish. We also believe that protecting wild fish is vitally important. So all of the groups that got together to push for this bill as drafted in the House, or as passed out of the House, did so for a good reason. There's some frustration with the lack of working toward a goal of having hatchery fish while protecting and rebuilding wild stocks. And I think that's what we all want. So we're here to support that bill, very simply, and thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for either of these gentlemen?
Just quickly, Joe, you've heard the testimony before. If we add a scientist to the list of 10, one or two, any objections?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, no, I don't have any objection to that. I'd looked at the existing board, and of the four designated scientists, two of them are fishery scientists, and they could easily make any of the other seats up. And out of the other folks that aren't scientists, there's a whole bunch of PhDs that are scientists. So I think it's just a mixed bag, and if that's the thing that we're going to break our pick over, put some seats on there and reserve them for scientists. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. Anybody else like to testify in House Bill 3441? Okay. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3441A, I should have said. And we're moving on to water. We are like a fish out of water now. Okay, so we're moving on to House Bill 3096A, and we have Representative Wisnett's going to present the bill. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You and I in water, right? I think you'll like this one. My name is Gene Wisnett. I'm State Representative, House District 53. And thank you very much for hearing the bill. Madam Chair and honorable colleagues, I bring you House Bill 3096. Which passed out of the House 60-0. It was amended, and you'll hear about that. But House Bill 3096 engrossed allows nonprofit and for-profit water improvement districts to own and operate sanitary sewer systems in existing developments where domestic water is already supplied by an ORS Chapter 554 corporation. ORS Chapter 554 allows communities developed before land use policy to operate water and sewer systems. This bill allows a community to combine the water and sewer operation into one entity. When we introduced the bill, as many bills get introduced in this session, we had someone that wanted to hop on our bill, and we were glad to do that. The Oregon Water Resource Congress amended the bill with a concurrence of the committee chair and myself to address improvement district housekeeping issues. And you'll hear from the Water Resource Congress amendment about their amendment, which aligns delinquent collection process for improvement districts with the processes used for irrigation districts and other similar types of districts. You're going to hear from Mr. Bruce White, representing River Meadows Homeowners Association in South Deschutes County, and you'll hear from the Water Resources Congress person on that amendment. Madam Chair, thank you for hearing the bill. I urge you to work it and pass this bill on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we can bring up Bruce and David. Do you want to stay?
I'll stay, but I would suggest and the Water Resource, get them all and we'll get.
Great. We'll have Bruce White and David Wayland. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you, Representative.
I will be brief. We are submitting written testimony, so I won't read the testimony in effort to make it quick.
But I could tell you were listening in the audience.
We were listening, paying attention.
Yes.
But
thank
did
you.
Drive over to Ben from Ben just to at least present some of our just brief arguments, but I will be brief. I manage the River Meadows Improvement District along with the Homeowner Association
Can you state your name for the record, please?
For the record, David Wayland, General Manager, River Meadows Improvement District.
Thank you.
A lot of what Representative Wisnett just said, I don't need to repeat, but our community is 239 lots, about 80% of which are developed. We have 160 acres along the Deschutes River, south of Sun River, north of Lapine. And we're made up of about an even split of homeowners, full-time residents, and partial, your second homes. A lot of our owners live in the Willamette Valley, Southern Oregon, that kind of thing. We were originally platted in the early 70s. We've been providing water since 1976 under state law, ORS Chapter 554. And then our sewer is provided by a separate private nonprofit corporation. And then we also have our homeowner association, which is a separate corporation. So we have several corporations. Again, I don't want to read.
Yeah. I guess what would be helpful is if you can explain what is the problem that we're trying to fix with this bill. That's what I often ask. So obviously you're here because there was a problem that came up. Can you maybe explain for us so the committee has a sense of what the issue was?
I'll go ahead and turn that over to our attorney.
Great.
For the record, my name is Bruce White. I'm an attorney in Bend, Oregon, and I'm legal counsel for the various entities that serve the River Meadows development. You've already heard where it's located and the fact that it predates land use planning. So we're not trying to do an end around the land use laws. We predate them, the bill has been drafted carefully to ensure that we're just dealing with existing situations and it doesn't create an opportunity for new development to come in and do an end around the prohibition on sewer and water services outside of UGBs. So the issue that we were faced with is how can we consolidate these operations of separate or of the sewer and water systems into one entity. And in the testimony that I handed out, I suggested that we considered three options on the first page of my testimony. And we chose the option to amend the statute and the authority of an ORS Chapter 554 improvement company for several reasons. And those reasons are in the testimony that goes over the turn of the page. One of the primary reasons was that, as Mr. Whalen stated, our owners are made up of a mix of resident and non-resident owners. If we were to go with a special district, we would be disenfranchising half of our owners because they're not residents. They wouldn't get to vote on elections for board members, and they wouldn't have the opportunity to serve. Secondly, if we were to become a special district, and there is a special district that allows for combinations and operations of combined sewer and water systems, we would be subject to a host of state laws that makes it more complicated for a layperson-type board to efficiently operate such a system. One of the primary ones is just how the elections are held, and we would be subject to elections held by the county clerk, which would perhaps discourage some of our owners from stepping up to actually serve. And as many of you know, trying to get people to serve on uncompensated nonprofit type boards can be difficult. And so also just by retaining the existing River Meadows Improvement District and folding the sewer into it, it would give a seamless transition from without any kind of break. We would simply need to transfer the sewer system to the existing ORS 554 corporation. I've set out also in my testimony the various sections and what they do. I think I don't need to repeat them here. The bill really is pretty simple. And as Representative Wisnant noted, there is a provision that was added at the request of the Oregon Water Resources Council. That's in Section 4 of the bill. And the bill actually is, there's, I think it's 8 pages. Much of that was just housekeeping work that was done by legislative council. These ORS Chapter 554 corporations are somewhat dated, and I think they felt there was a need to update the statute with various housekeeping changes. So with that, you can read my testimony. I think I've given you kind of the essence of it, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for either this gentleman?
I have one. Sir, could you point out in Section 4 where the irrigation districts got in there?
Well, I think there's a provision in Section 4 that talks about collecting deficient accounts in the manner that...
And we have, they're coming up next to talk about that.
Well, I think that might be in Section 3. That's why I wanted to ask to make sure.
Oh, then if so, then that would be my mistake. But
that's fine. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well,
thank you.
We will have April Snell from the Water Resources Congress come up in just a minute. But any other questions for these gentlemen? You know, I do have one quick question. So, well, first of all, I'm glad to say this is an actual sewer collection system you're talking about.
Correct.
Water, which,
yes.
I'm glad to see, especially because it's along the river, as the representative and I know. You know, it's been sort of an issue out there.
Sure.
So how are the rates set?
The rates are just set with just basically to cover our expenses. As a nonprofit entity, you know, we cover all of our collections and our fees. We're permitted through the Department of Environmental Quality, obviously, but we just set our rates just basically to cover the expenses, and it's been low. $30 a month covers the sewer. It's...
And then the water portion, is that regulated through the PUC? I know that the PUC does regulate some of our water corporations.
Through DHS, I believe, regulates the water for us.
Because it's a community water system?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right. I don't know if there's any other questions. Did you have anything else you want to add, Representative?
No, thank you, Senator. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Representative. And we'll have April come up and talk about she wants to add anything. Anybody else like to testify in House Bill 3096A? Okay. April.
For the record, April Snell, Executive Director with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. Representative Wisnett did indicate that we did have a minor housekeeping issue, which is in Section 3, and that is to clarify the manner in which improvement districts can collect upon delinquent charges. Our association represents agricultural water suppliers, which include improvement districts as well as irrigation districts. And the improvement district statutes are currently missing some key language that the other district statutes have about how they actually collect upon delinquent charges. So it does not expand any authority or make any substantive changes, simply clarifies the manner in which these delinquent folks are collected upon. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about that.
Okay, Senator Olson, did you have a question?
No, I just wanted to make sure that I knew where it was. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Hansel? Nope. All right.
Thank you for your
time. Thank you very much. Okay, so we don't have anybody else like to testify on that bill, so we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3096A. We'll open up our last public hearing of the day, but just a reminder to members, we are going to move into work session afterwards, so we'll have to corral everyone back. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2820B. Beth, can you provide us a overview?
Madam Chair, House Bill 2820B adds solar thermal power plants to energy facility listing list requiring FSEC approval to find solar photovoltaic power generation facilities using more than...
You can say PV.
Yeah, I think that's probably good. Using more than 100 acres of high-value farmland or arable land, or using more than 320 acres of other land as energy facility requiring FSEC approval, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. We have Todd Cornett from Department of Energy. Todd, you're going to come up and tell us the history of this bill. It's been around for a while, and what this current version does. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Siting Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Energy, and I'm not sure where we're at in terms of schedule and timing. I can give you an abbreviated version, or I can go into the more detailed version and kind of... in addition to the problem statement, kind of give you an overview of kind of how we got here.
Yeah, why don't you do that? And we do have a number of people like to testify, but I think it's important that we have the background on this bill.
I'd be happy to do that. So I'm going to jump first to pages 5 and 6 of the handout, and this is to really distinguish thermal solar from solar photovoltaic. There is a distinction between the two, and there's some differentiations in the bill related to the two. And since many people don't know the difference between the two of them, I thought that might be a good place to start. So page 5 starts with concentrating solar or thermal solar. And I'm just going to read through what it says. It's a system that uses mirrors or lenses to concentrate a large area of sunlight or solar thermal energy onto a small area. Electrical power is produced when the concentrated light is converted to heat, which drives a heat engine, usually a steam turbine, connected to an electrical power generator. So as you can see, the distinction in here is you have a central tower, and the panels don't absorb sunlight. They concentrate it at the central place, which is that tower power. That creates heat and steam, and the facility located at the base of the tower functions more or less like a natural gas thermal facility. So there's a lot of day-to-day usage of it, employees. So it functions very differently than if you turn the page to the solar photovoltaic, and that's what people are typically interested in or used to. And this is what we're likely to see mostly in Oregon right now, which is a method of generating electrical power by converting solar radiation into direct current electricity using semiconductors that exhibit the photovoltaic effect. So the big difference here is, while they're both large-scale footprint impacts, the solar PV is simply, once it's established, it's really largely minimal impact. There's not a lot of day-to-day activities associated with it. So there's a very different in terms of operational characteristics. So the problem statement is really in the existing statute, ORS 469.311, is the definition for energy facilities. And that, in effect, functions as the jurisdictional threshold for when something goes from the local jurisdiction to the Energy Facility Siting Council. And for solar, there are two existing solar siting thresholds, and that's the problem. They're in conflict. And you can see, starting near the bottom of page one, under the definition of energy facility, currently under sub D, there is a 100-acre one, and that's 100-acre, and the way it's written is basically for both solar and solar PV and solar thermal. And so 100 acres would be equivalent to about 10 to 20 megawatts. And this was originally established in 1975. The other one in subsection J is a 35 megawatt average generating capacity. That's typically referred to as the 105 megawatt because that's what it would be for a maximum generating capacity if it was generating at 100% capacity. It's currently listed as basically being a third efficient. So in order to have a 105 megawatt operating facility or a 35 megawatt operating facility, it would have to be three times that in terms of the nameplate capacity because it does not function at 100% of the time. So this would be equivalent to any a range between 525 and 1,050 acres in order to accommodate that. So this was established in 1991 as a 25-megawatt threshold. It was increased to a 35-megawatt threshold in 1991. Both of these times, there was no sort of alteration of the other 100-acre threshold. So as these were changed or updated, those weren't altered. And really, the problem is that you're never going to get to the 35 megawatts or 105 megawatts before you reach 100 acres. That's always going to trigger first. And so, in effect, what we have today is a 100-acre threshold, regardless of the fact that there's another threshold that's listed. So that's the problem. There is some discussion or discrepancy about whether the 100-acre is really intended to be for a thermal facility. It doesn't read that way. It doesn't use that language. And without any case law or testing, as I said, in effect, it's a 100-acre threshold. I don't believe that anybody is satisfied with that threshold, and so the design of the bill is to fix that. So a working group was established previous to this over the past summer. This was the House Interim Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water, and this was chaired by Representative Boone, and there was quite a bit of work that was done on the bill. And there is a wide diversity of interests at the table, and really we ended up with what I'm going to call general consensus. There was no votes. Not everybody necessarily was on board with everything, but as I'm going to go through and kind of indicate these, I'll say that there was general consensus on all of these points as they sort of have played out into the bill currently. The first is that the solar thermal and the solar PV should be a separate jurisdictional threshold. As you see, they function differently, as I talked about. The bill does that. The bill takes the thermal thermal facility and puts it into what's already existing thermal facility in the definition, which is a 25-megawatt threshold. Basically, it parks it over there. There's not really much interest on the horizon for the solar thermal facilities. Nobody was really concerned about that, so it seemed like a logical place to park it, and nobody expressed any concern about that. That's what's reflected in the bill. There was a consensus that for solar PV, because of the footprint impact, again, the operational impact is fairly benign, but the siting development impact and the sheer taking out of production whatever was there before, that's the impact. And so because it was a large-scale footprint impact, the acreage threshold was the best option for that rather than a megawatt threshold. And so the bill does that. And so, again, there was consensus on that. There was consensus that the acreage threshold for solar PV should be based upon the variations of what exists on the ground. And as we're looking at where these large-scale commercial or utility scale solar facilities would likely to be will be in the exclusive farm use zone. So what seemed logical was to look at soil productivity, and so the thresholds are largely based on soil productivity. We have, at least currently, it has it listed under high-value farmland threshold, an arable lands threshold, and an other lands threshold. And that was originally listed as a non-arable lands threshold in order to kind of complete the three distinctions. But that ended up being arable and to accommodate all other zoning designations as well. So that last one is really everything else. So in addition to the least productive soils, it includes every other zoning designation out there, commercial, industrial, residential, rural residential, all others. So there was consensus that the acreage threshold on high-value and arable land should be 100 acres, and that's what's listed in there in the bill currently. And there is consensus that for the non-arable or the least productive farmlands, that the acreage threshold should be based upon how large-scale farms really function and divided, and that's really based upon kind of sections. So you know, typically large-scale farms in eastern Oregon are divided and utilized in multitudes of sections, so 640 acres or a mile by a mile. So everybody agreed upon that concept as well. And then that's when at least the working group kind of lost consensus about what that threshold should be. So there was variation of whether it should be 320, it should be a half a section, or 640, a full section. And that's kind of where that group ended. As this bill has made its way through, it previously included a 640-acre threshold. It's been dropped down to a 320-acre threshold right now. And again, one of the big issues that we did not consider was sort of the other zoning designations, and that's why that final version ended up being 320 acres on all other lands to accommodate other zoning designations as well. So that's currently what's in the bill. There is sort of an outstanding issue that I think is important to understand, and so my apologies, but that was the easy stuff, and now it kind of gets a little more complicated.
And you're talking about now the dash, the amendments.
Yeah, and I think that there's various...
And was this from ODA? Where do these amendments come from?
Which one do you have?
Madam Chair, just to clarify for the people in the audience, I think you're referring just to your proposed foreign amendments.
So this is coming from ODA, right?
Yeah, is this the striking of arable lands? Mm-hmm. And the,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Chair Dingfield, members of the committee. So the reference is to a very recent, as of yesterday, proposed amendment to the existing bill. And this is in response to concerns about the definition of arable lands. So I'm just going to go through kind of the testimony. So I think AOC probably has a proposal that they're going to be bringing up. We've been working with Legislative Council with that concept as well. Really, this is to kind of frame up that we haven't resolved this outstanding issue that I'm going to bring to you right now. And so I'm going to try to frame it in terms of how we're making the proposed amendment. And the first is to remove the definition of arable lands altogether. So right now under the solar PV, there's a reference to arable land. There's a reference to high value. High value already has a definition. I put that's at the very end of their handout. So that's in statute. There is no definition of arable land or non-arable land in statute, and so that was where we were struggling, is how to deal with that. There are definitions of arable land and non-arable land in DLCD's solar siting rule. So the struggle was to how to deal with that, and so we originally put in this arable lands definition, which is different than DLCD's solar siting rule. Now, DLCD's solar siting rule is for the purposes of establishing which standards apply when somebody submits an application for a solar siting facility.
We have Michael Morrissey here. Michael, can you come up and join him? Because I'm trying to figure a little triage here. If you can I'm assuming you're going to be probably wanting to comment on that. So
as it's written, it basically creates what we need in this bill, which is a definitive, non-discretionary process whereby it's sort of an if-then. If you're this, then you go to the county, or if you're this, then you go to FSEC. That's how this definition was written. It's different than the way the solar siting rule was written, definitions written. And the distinction is, as I wrote down here, is that the language that wasn't included is as determined by the governing body or its designate based on substantial evidence in the record of a local land use application. And so the way it currently works in DLCD solar siting rule is in order to determine should it not be predominantly cultivated, under the sign of subsection B, if not currently cultivated, predominantly composed of soils that are in capability, and then the addition that DLCD has is as determined based upon a local land use decision. Well, the problem with that in our process is this is a jurisdictional threshold that's being created, and this would add a discretionary land use decision by a local government simply to determine who has jurisdiction. So the attempt here was to kind of strip out that discretionary process in order to, again, create just sort of a very clear if-then. So our proposal was to eliminate the arable lands because we recognize it's having two different definitions can create complexity and confusion, and so we wanted to try to resolve that. And so we proposed to eliminate that, and under the second section on page 4, we basically pulled that same language out and put it into the jurisdictional threshold. So you have the solar PV, which says solar photovoltaic power generation facility using more than 100 acres on high-value farmland, which is defined in statute. And then this is the new language, 100 acres located on, and it would strike out arable, and it would be land and still use that same language that is either predominantly cultivated, so that's a clear establishment, or if not cultivated, predominantly composed of soils that are in capability class 1 through 4 as specified by NRCS. This still retains it as a clear and objective jurisdictional threshold. And the problem you're going to hear from counties, and we completely understand this and respect their desire to have kind of local discretion about this, because not all soils are created equal. There are some class 4 soils that are non-productive. There are some class 6 soils that are very highly productive. So using these terms, arable and non-arable, they're not clean. They're not, you know, absolutely objective. And the way we're trying to use this is objective. And the reason why we're using it is we're trying to rectify or to recognize some differentiation on the ground and have some flexibility in the jurisdictional threshold to allow, you know, to incentivize non-arable or low-productive properties to have these solar facilities at a higher acreages being reviewed by the local government. But it doesn't, the way this is written, it doesn't resolve the fact that, you know, it is inconsistent or it is different than the way it's being used in the solar siting rule. And I know the counties would rather have some local determination to determine what constitutes arable and what constitutes non-arable. We understand that. We don't disagree with it. It just simply doesn't function properly the way we need it to function to have a very clear clearly established jurisdictional threshold where applicants know where to go. So,
all right, thank you. We have the Department of Land Conservation Development here. That did you want to add anything, Michael, on that?
Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Michael Morsi. I'm a policy analyst with Department of Land Conservation and Development. Just a few things. These statutes, the statutes that are up for change, possible change, are not ones that affect us directly. But the issue of solar siting, perhaps, started because several counties approached our department and said, we're working with some developers, and photovoltaic is, it's on its way, it's coming. And there is some solar built currently in Lake County, and actually there's at least one small site near McMinnville. So we spent about a year and a half doing rulemaking on siting of solar facilities. And part of what we're dealing with today is kind of the tail end of what started as the department rulemaking. I'm not aware at this point of any other major pieces of contention. This bill's come a long way. There has been major areas of disagreement, and now we're kind of high-centered on this rock in the stream, and I hope we can get over it, over that rock. The exact point that's really up for discussion and perhaps the last one to be resolved, short of anything else that the committee might want to deal with, is you're a solar developer, where do you take your permit? You want to walk through a door and get your permit processed, and the point here is, do you go to FSEC and say, please take this, or do you go to a county, and do you do that with confidence that you haven't gone through the wrong door? So our interests in this are that there are no new definitions of arable lands or non-arable lands that would cause confusion or interfere with the ones that we've put in rule, that after the correct jurisdiction has been chosen, whichever it is, whether it's the county or FSEC, that they will still use then apply the standards that are on our rule for the processing of the permit. We were asked, and we did work with the Department of Energy very recently to try to help them come up with a version that would satisfy our objectives, and I thought we did that, although I've seen recently an LC draft, and now I'm not so sure. I will say that in working with them, we also had in mind the counties, which you'll hear is a slightly different point of view. We're not taking sides on this particularly. We're just trying to help make sure that any position that comes forward is one that basically satisfies our objectives and are workable. Maybe I should just stop right there.
I can say that's probably wise. Okay, thank you, Michael. All right. Well, we actually have this bill because Senator Olson told me he was missing land use so much from this committee. That's why we brought it forward to you. So here we have solar and land use. So any questions for these gentlemen? I think we're going to hear that this is still a work in progress, especially on the amendment. We have many people that would like to testify that are going to tell us probably what they think one way or another, but we have the experts up here who have been working on this. So Senator Hansel.
More of a point of clarification. The B in gross does not include what you just covered with arable and the other
Correct.
Amendments. That has yet to be considered. It's not. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Okay, we're going to go down the list here of folks who'd like to come up and testify. We have Ken Safe from the Oregon Military Department. Thank you for your patience, everyone. Glenn Montgomery and Barner Seaman. We've gone from hatcheries to water to solar. Here we are. Why don't we have Mr. Safe from the Oregon Military Department. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, Chairman Dingfelter and fellow committee members. My name is Kenneth Safe, Lieutenant Colonel with the Oregon Military Department. We've been involved on this for quite some time with ODO and many others on the committee. The Oregon Military Department, bottom line, is still in support of House Bill 2820. It provides support to both the former Air Force backscatter radar site near Christmas Valley and the former Umatilla Army Depot in Umatilla, which 7,500 acres is in the process of being transferred to the Oregon National Guard, which is expected to be completed this year, we hope. In April of 2011, the Oregon Military Department was selected to be part of the Department of the Army's Net Zero Energy Pilot Program, which is also aligned well with the goals and objectives of the governor's 10-year energy action plan. The plan consists of energy reduction and efficiency associated with the agency facilities and the production of renewable energy to meet the balance of the energy needs. OMB is planning for up to 20 megawatts of solar power at the Christmas Valley site for our own use. But additionally, there is a Department of Defense interest in meeting the 3 gigawatts at military sites like this. The long-term goal is to enhance our national security and reduce the dependence on foreign oil by providing locally produced renewable energy. A 20-megawatt solar array is expected to cover approximately 160 to 180 acres based on what we've been able to determine so far at that location. And passing this bill will help facilitate a solar development necessary for our agency's goals. I would like to just add that OMD recognizes there are many advocates and interests in this, and that we feel that we are appropriate stewards of the land use in this state. OMD has an award-winning environmental team section that maintains all of the Oregon Military Department land to the highest standards. That's all I have.
Thank you. Glenn.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, the trade group that represents manufacturers, installers, and others who advocate for solar in Oregon. I took a neutral stance on this bill in part because of the pending amendments, and until the dust settled, I felt it unwise to actually take a specific position, but I know we're moving in the right direction, and I appreciate all the work that the folks have done behind the scenes who have been working on this bill and establishing a compromise that we can pass through committee. I do want to mention to you, however, that recently OSEA had commissioned a report called The Vision to Integrate Solar in Oregon. And much of the substance of this report is on large-scale solar development and what the possibility is for us here in this state. The author, Chris Robertson, who has 30 years of experience in utility and power production, asserts that we could achieve 20% of our power through solar energy, in large part using utility-scale generation. And that 20% of power would equate to roughly 65 square miles of land. Now, obviously, that would be spread throughout the state, but just to give you an idea of that scale, Lake County alone has roughly 8,500 square miles. So we have one county that dwarfs the scale of what we would need to produce one-fifth of our energy supply using solar. So I have submitted that in electronic form to the committee, the Visor report, the Vision to Integrate Solar in Oregon, that accompanies my testimony. And I encourage you to look over the executive summary, which is just a few pages as opposed to the 60-page report. And I thank you for your time, and I will be happy to answer any questions on that.
Thank you. Varner?
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm the policy director for Renewable Northwest Project, representing developers of solar and wind and geothermal resources here in the Pacific Northwest. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2820, with the understanding that is being discussed here, there's some work yet to be done to make sure that we've got the language on arable lands exactly right. The one note I would make about this bill is, as folks are considering it and as you're deliberating on it, is what we're establishing here for the thresholds are just which permitting body do you have to go through. And it's really, when we talk about the FSEC thresholds, it's if you're using more than the acreage which is spelled out, you lose having a choice between going through a county process or the FSEC process, and above a certain size, you have to go through the FSEC process. What I would caution folks being worried about is too much in this bill is you still have to go through a permitting process, and having a background of working for a renewable energy development company in the state, that still, and looking at Senator Hansel, who I think has some experience in terms of what that permitting process looks like, there's still quite a bit of work to do. In our minds, we're not taking a position, or Renewable Northwest Project isn't taking a position on which amendment or which language is the right solution on the arable lands, other than to say we should work this out and we should move forward with the bill. And we think that we're pretty close on the compromise that's been reached so far. We think we can work through these issues, and we think that this is good policy moving forward to encourage some additional development and economic benefit that comes from renewable energy projects here in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? Any of these gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have the Association of Oregon Counties, Doris Pinwell, Brian Dougherty, and Stephen Kapori. Come on up. I guess it looks like Stephen's left, so Steve McCoy. Doris, why don't you go
okay,
first?
I will.
Yep.
Good afternoon, committee members, Senator Dingfelder, and the rest of you committee members. My name is Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties. And in addition, in this regard, the county planners that work for all the counties in Oregon, they have quite a bit of experience with siting, in certain counties, siting of energy facilities and transmission facilities, and work closely with FSEC in the processes, whether it's at their level or at the FSEC level. So I want to tell you that, first of all, we're highly supportive of the bill before you, with the exception of this one issue that has to do with arable lands and Before I go any further, I should just say that we, after talking to many of the parties, we finally were convinced that what we needed to do was take out the definition of arable lands in this bill, because it did conflict with the definition we have to use under DLCD rules in order to site PV solar facilities. One of the other things I think I should tell you is that the land use planners and public officials get involved with FSEC when they get an, first of all, they get involved with developers when they're interested in looking for a site in Oregon. They come to the counties to review their soils maps. That's an important first step, regardless of where you're going, at the county level or at the FSEC level. A developer must do this before submitting their application. And then, currently, we think the process works well. It doesn't take a lot of time for counties to give some advice on what kind of soils are involved with the particular location and some other issues that they may be interested in. During the FSEC process, if a developer finally decides to go to FSEC, and they can choose that at whatever level, regardless of what is in this bill, they can choose to go to FSEC anyway rather than through the county process. But if they decide to go to FSEC, even under the solar situation here, FSEC, under the current process, sends a copy, a notice to all of the involved parties, including the county in which the facility would be located. And they ask the county to provide any applicable substantive criteria that would be used at the county level, including such things as soil classifications and other land use issues. And that is sent back to FSEC for their determination, not for the county determination. So we do have an involvement with them, and this is why we felt that the arable lands definition had to be used for two different reasons, one for thresholds at FSEC, but the other for use under the county permitting process and any advice we give to FSEC. So we simply proposed the amendment B9 that just took out the definition. We didn't change anything else other than that request. Now, we're still in conversations with DLCD, Department of Energy, and other parties to be sure that we get this right. And sometimes you don't, but at least we'll get as far as we can to make this right so that we can move ahead and finally have some ability to site a solar facility in Eastern Oregon, where I know they'd like to have a facility. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Why don't we hear all the testimony and we'll see if there's questions. And just, I'm sure you know that we don't have that much time as
yes,
far as if we
know.
Need to make some changes for this amendment. So, Brian?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brian Doherty testifying on behalf of the City and Renewables. And to quote a phrase from prior testimony, I'm representing the entity that's trying not to get hung up on the high rock in the stream. we support House Bill 2820 as it came to you. We support Mr. Cornett's amendments if they can get through. We are concerned with the amount of time and decisions that you have left. We have many entities and organizations and agencies that have worked very hard on this. As the chair said earlier, this has been around the block for a while, and it's come to a good result. What we've tried to do is expand the amount of acreage that you could use for a solar facility in non-high-value land. This definition of arable land has come up recently. We hope it can be fixed. We think it can be fixed in other places. We appreciate the county's concern. We also appreciate FSEC, DLCD, Renewable Northwest, Thousand Friends, all the others that have come around to this. We hope there is something that can be done. We think that the bill, as you have it, could pass and this issue could be resolved in another bill or another manner. But we do see Mr. Cornett's version as something we could support. Let me tell you why we're concerned about the county version of just removing the arable land definition. And that is because we see that as then the county making a land use decision requiring a hearing and subject to appeal, which could put another year onto the development problem. if you have a clear definition in here, it is not subject to such a challenge. So that is what is concerning us mostly. It is that it can cause delay, expense, or even cancellation of the project because of that type of delay. Thank you very much. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. And Steve, you get the last word today.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on HB 2820B. So you've heard that we've worked very hard on this bill. Many parties have been involved, and it says something that I'm sitting here at the same table with Obsidian, and we're agreeing that we support this bill. Which I think is an excellent result. We don't want to see things get hung up on the arable lands issue either. Essentially, there's a tension here between county discretion and between, exact knowledge of certainty on the part of developers about what door to walk through, as it was put earlier. We are agnostic on that issue. Either way would be fine, as long as the acreage thresholds that are in the bill are maintained. Thank you.
And you have you seen what's being proposed by Todd Grant from ODO?
Yes, I looked at his testimony. I saw it in an email yesterday as well. I do think there's one little technical glitch with it right now, that the ore is aligned too high and there's a period. So there's a little I, an II, and an III. The II has a period at the end of it. The I has an or at the end of it. The or should be at the end of the II, and the period should be at the end of the III.
Well, we have lawyers. Yeah. You're surrounded by them. Yeah, right.
Sounds like old McDonald.
I know. And I'll have a question.
Now you know.
Brian, have you looked at ODO's amendment?
Yes, and I provided that to Ms. Riley today.
Yeah.
Those amendments, we are supportive of, okay. Mr. Cordes.
So it's just the dash nines at this time, the B9s.
The B9s are the county's
right.
Amendments.
Okay.
Those we had some concern with.
Right, and we have the B9s, but we do not have whatever the B, it'll be 10s or something yet. We just have, that's off to LC. Okay, great. We'll see if there's any questions. Senator Hansel.
Doris, do you have any, how do you respond to Mr. Doherty's concerns?
With the concern about
arable.
A local land use decision.
Well, the arable land.
Well, in my testimony, I went through some detail about what the situation was. In eastern Oregon, the soils classifications, especially soil 4, could be arable or it could be not. And I think everybody agrees that's the case. It's not a matter, and the counties in the solar land use rule have some discretion because of those kinds of issues. The soil classification is not really precise across all lands. So currently, the counties are allowed to make a determination of what kind of land it is, and they give advice to FSEC. They also use it for themselves under land use decisions. But we really believe that the advice we give to FSEC does not constitute a, quote, land use decision, because it's their advice to FSEC. FSEC is the body that will make the decision, and if there's an appeal of what they do, it goes to a different level rather than to LUBA. So I think we're talking about two separate things here. The planners will tell you that when they get information from FSEC or from others, it takes no time at all to make a decision on what kind of soils it is. They work with them every day. They have access to those maps, and they don't think that's really a hang-up. And in fact, they think that it helps to streamline the process to have input.
Thank you. That's helpful. Any other questions? All right. Well, it sounds like this is still a work in progress, but I know this has been going on for many years, and I think it's gone through every committee just about that does land use in the Capitol. But so appreciate all the hard work, and obviously we will be hearing more. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill, on House Bill 2820B? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2820B. We have three work sessions next, and then we will be adjourned. So first we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2005A. Beth, I believe we have an amendment. Can you talk us through that amendment?
Madam Chair, there's a dash A4 amendment which increases the makeup of the mechanical board to 10 members and restores the role of the building official that has the no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact statement on the dash A4 amendment that you have in front of you.
Okay, I will take a motion on that.
Chair Dingfelter, I move to adopt the dash A4 amendment dated 5-10-2013.
Okay, Senator Olson moves to adopt the dash A4 amendment stated 5-10-2013. Is there any discussion? Senator Hess?
I just want to applaud the efforts of the department to make that amendment, and it goes a long ways to making this good. I appreciate the work.
Thank you. All right, any other discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the... Oh, is there any objection to the A4 amendments? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Dingfelter, I move House Bill 2005A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2005A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelter.
Aye. That motion carries. And Senator Hass, you haven't carried a bill for a while.
I'd be delighted to.
Okay. Thank you. Didn't sound that enthusiastic, but this one isn't too complicated. I thought you'd like this one.
I'd be delighted to.
Okay. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2005A. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2031.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2031 be reported out of committee with a do pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Olson moves that House Bill 2031 be reported out of committee with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this bill? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelter.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and Senator Bates, I think you have not carried a bill in a while.
I would be delighted to.
Great. Thank you. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2031. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2032A.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2032A be reported out of committee with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2032A be reported out of committee with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this bill? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. I think
Senator
everyone's
Bates.
Tired.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelter.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and actually I will carry this bill because I don't think I've carried a bill in a while. We've had Senator Olson and Senator Hansel have been doing all the heavy lifting in this committee, so we'll take on some of our own. Okay, anything else? Let me close the work session on that bill, which was House Bill 2032A. Is there anything else for the good of the order?
Madam Chair, you've already carried over House Bill 2025 and 2801.
Thank you for that reminder. And with that, we will see everybody on Monday. Is that correct?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. With that, we are adjourned. And thank you for your patience.